Athens News Matters is sponsored in part by the WUGA Community Advisory Council, dedicated and involved individuals who help WUGA stay connected with our listeners, community organizations, and issues in the Athens area. Learn more at WUGA.org.
Today on Athens News Matters, as the Omicron variant of the coronavirus dominates the headlines, we'll talk to Dr. John Drake, an expert on disease modeling, about how scientists can not only track but actually anticipate disease outbreaks.
The variants that we've seen arise when there are specific mutations that give the virus new properties. If we have a model of how those changes occur, then maybe we can infer some things about how quickly it's spreading.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Also today, it's the holiday season, for many a time of giving. But what's the best way to help the causes you care about? We'll consider whether it's best to volunteer your time or donate your money to organizations that help others. Those stories and more coming up on Athens News Matters.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Monroe, Sao Paulo,
Beirut, London.
Reporting from bunkers, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Chris Shoup. Omicron is yet another variant of COVID-19, and researchers and public health officials are actively working on figuring out more information on this new twist in the ongoing saga of the coronavirus. While public health officials are working to track where the virus is, other researchers are looking ahead, modeling the future of the disease and its spread. Dr. John Drake is a professor at the University of Georgia's Odom School of Ecology and the director of the University Center for the Ecology of Infectious Diseases. Welcome back to Athens News Matters. And I'm Chris Shoup. Omicron is yet another variant of COVID-19, and researchers and public health officials are actively working on figuring out more information on this new twist in the ongoing saga of the coronavirus. While public health officials are working to track where the virus is, other researchers are looking ahead, modeling the future of the disease and its spread. Dr. John Drake is a professor at the University of Georgia's Odom School of Ecology and the director of the University Center for the Ecology of Infectious Diseases. Welcome back to Athens News Matters.
Good morning, Chris.
So before we get into the actual variant, let's just revisit quickly the process of modeling an infectious disease. What key factors are examined when creating a model for a disease?
Basically, what a model is it's a representation of what we think is going on in some process in nature. And so with infectious diseases, we might, for instance, be developing a model for the transmission or the movement of a virus in space. And actually, in the case of Omicron, one of the things that I think will be most useful in the coming weeks is evolutionary models.
Sounds interesting. Tell me a little bit more about evolutionary models.
The virus itself has a genome, and as an RNA virus, that genome mutates a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The variants that we've seen arise when there are specific mutations that give the virus new properties. If we have a model of how those changes occur, then maybe we can infer some things about how quickly it's spreading.
I suspect there's nothing actually easy about any of this, but is it somewhat easier to model a variant of a pre-existing disease than, say, a new infectious agent?
Certainly. So when the SARS coronavirus 2, which is the virus that causes COVID-19, was first discovered in late 2019 and early 2020, we knew very little about its transmission. How is it that people caught it from one another?
Right.
Of course, the thing that we have to figure out now is how is Omicron going to respond in the face of vaccine pressure? Our vaccines were developed to target earlier variants, including Alpha and Delta. We don't yet know how well they will work against Omicron.
Mm.
And there are some clues in the gene sequence of the Omicron virus that suggest it may not work as well against Omicron as it does against Delta.
Interesting. I know we have the current COVID models. What more can those models sort of suggest as we look at Omicron?
Well, one of the things that we know from modeling exercises is that it's very, very difficult to keep a virus out of a place. But there has been very rapid response around the world limiting the movement of people. And I suppose to some extent that might be useful with respect to Omicron, to buy a little bit of time as we develop our response. But one of the things that model shows us is that that is not a long-term effective response.
As we look back at COVID-19 in general, tell us a little bit more about how these models have actually helped public officials decide certain steps towards trying to contain the virus.
One of the things that I think they're very useful for is looking at the effectiveness of different practices and policies. So for instance, the effectiveness of face masks, which we know to be effective against all variants. Another thing that we can use models for is decision support. So we can ask if-then questions. One of the things that models have shown us is that if we would deploy vaccines more effectively, if we would have higher vaccine coverage, then containment would actually be much more achievable. But there's also the willingness on the part of the population to receive those vaccines. And models can't solve that problem for us.
Well, I know there is so much that we don't know, especially about this new variant. But just based on what you do know, what are some of the concerns we should have about this new variant?
So most of what we know about Omicron at this stage does come from the gene sequence. We know that the key vaccine manufacturers like Pfizer and Moderna and Johnson & Johnson are studying the effectiveness of their vaccines against the Omicron variant. And we can expect data from these companies probably within another week to 10 days or so. One thing that's really important is that there have been 32 separate mutations associated with just one gene known as S because it codes for the spike protein. The spike protein is important because it's found on the immune response and it's therefore the standard vaccine target. So it's for this reason that it's quite possible that Omicron could be what people are calling an escape variant. In addition to these mutations that might confer immune escape, there's another interesting angle, which is something called S-target gene failure. S, or spike, is just one of the genes that's targeted by PCR. And in some of these PCR tests, the S gene fails. So we fail to detect the spike protein. And so when that happens, what you have is a PCR test that that says there's something special about this variant. I expect many countries around the world will be using S gene target failure to try and follow the path of Omicron during the epidemic. And I expect here in the U.S. we'll primarily focus on genome sequencing.
So what does all this mean for our listeners as we all move into the holidays?
You know, Chris, the thing to remember is that the greatest threat in the U.S. remains the Delta variant. And we know that the vaccine works very well to protect against Delta. People who haven't been vaccinated should seek a vaccine if they're eligible. And then the other thing is that masks and physical distancing work against all variants.
Fair enough. Dr. John Drake is a professor at UGA and the director of the University Center for the Ecology of Infectious Diseases. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you, Chris. It's my pleasure.
Dr. John Drake is a professor in the University of Georgia's Odom School of Ecology and director of the University Center for the Ecology of Infectious Diseases.
I'm Tim Franks. From the biggest breaking stories of the day to the important issues and trends, we're there.
This is an historic victory and what is a very important day.
This could change world history.
Everybody's going to pay a price. He will, everybody will.
And I am just so happy to be home and to put my feet on this land again.
Another huge development.
Join me and my colleagues for NewsHour from the BBC.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley. Last month, the National Low-Income Housing Coalition singled out Georgia, as well as Ohio, Arizona, and Tennessee, in a report on states that have been slow to disperse federal aid to renters at risk of eviction. By the middle of last month, less than 10% of $550 million had gone out to help Georgia residents struggling with rent or utility payments during the pandemic. That money is part of $46.5 billion in rental assistance that Congress approved for U.S. communities. Facing pressure, Georgia officials submitted plans to the U.S. Department of Treasury that outline how they will increase the speed at which they get money to landlords and renters. If these plans aren't approved, Georgia risks losing some of that $550 million to communities that have dispersed aid faster. Here to talk about that, plus the rest of the weekend news, are Chris Dowd with Athens Politics Nerd and Gwen O'Looney with WXAG. So what exactly has been the holdup in getting this money out?
It's not the Fed's fault. They have gotten rid of their money on a regular schedule that was set up at the very beginning. So they've done a good job. The problem gets bogged down, and it's easiest in those states that have a full commitment to Medicaid because they have a distribution system and the list and all this stuff.
Yeah, I think some people just don't know they can apply. First of all, I think the application process is really cumbersome and they haven't really done much to try to make that easier yet. And when people do apply, they don't hear anything or they don't hear anything for a long time. And I think that it is something difficult to do, especially if we don't have the infrastructure set up, like you said, Gwen. But also I think it's not really a priority, I think, or it's not, they don't, I don't get the sense that they really feel the urgency to do something with this money, which is a shame.
Chris, that's a very good point. You know, slowness of process, as I think Chris made an excellent point, that it's just torturous for people who are on the edge of eviction or in eviction status.
Well, ACC commissioners will see a contract with the Athens First Development Corporation for distributing local eviction relief. So let's review what the program does and what some of the opposition has looked like. Start with you on that, Chris.
Okay. So this is modeled after Gwinnett's Project Reset. And so what it'll do is it, when people are facing eviction, the city government or someone contracting with them will sort of step in and negotiate instead of going through the court system and, you know, the eviction process. They'll step in and just have a negotiation between, you know, with the landlord. And the landlord, normally during an eviction, the landlord doesn't get anything. They get the person out of the house so they can rent it out again, but they don't get any of the back rent. But with this eviction prevention program, they'll get something like 60 or 70% of the back rent that they were owed. And in exchange, they reset the person, the renter, back to where they were when they first moved in. So it gets rid of all like late fees and things like that. And then it just starts them over. It gives them a second chance. So I think it's a great program. And I hope that we'll get it off the ground here soon.
Right. I agree with Chris. And we're really lucky because what you were saying about getting the money out, they're committed to getting the money out. And the other thing that this new program is responsible to do is a 6-month follow-up. And so that would be a very accurate indication of their accountability and how well they've done. And I think that kind of monitoring, self-monitoring, is really important.
And 6 months is a good bit of time to see what's working, what's not working. And you don't have to wait too long to right the ship or see, hey, this works, let's keep this up.
Yeah, the only concern that I think commissioners have about this program is that there's only one applicant to their request for proposals. And this particular group, Athenian First, doesn't really have any experience doing anything like this or providing direct services like this. So I think that is the only concern that they have, and maybe the only reason why, you know, if it doesn't get approved, that would be the reason why. Although I do think it's an important program and maybe we should give them a shot.
Moving on, Chris, you posted a video that retired paramedic Bob Gadd made requesting that the Athens mayor and commission begin moving toward a public EMS service through the fire department instead of the current contract we have with National EMS, which is a private EMS service that's received criticism for slow response times. Let's play some of that audio here.
I hate this expression, but I think you guys need to put on your big boy pants and grow up and do your jobs and start the process of having a county-based EMS housed in the fire department. Like a million communities all over the world do. It's the only way it's going to make a difference here, because these guys are incapable of changing. They're too money driven. They're bought by a private equity firm, not because they're losing money, but because they were earning tons of money.
So Bob Gatt has been pushing on this issue for several years now. Bob used to work for them, actually. Then he left. He says he feels that they only care about profits and not about doing a good job. I don't know the truth of that exactly, but that's what he says. And so he quit and he went to work in another county nearby that has a public EMS system. And he likes that a lot better. So that's what he's pushing for here. And so they've been very critical about response times for national EMS. And they don't give out their numbers. So we don't really know what their numbers actually are. And of course they say that everything is fine, but since there's no real oversight of this group that is owned by a private equity fund, which I have no problem with in concept, but I think when you have a profit motive involved for something like public safety, you really need to have a lot of transparency and oversight, which we don't have here. So we do have an EMS oversight committee, but that group hasn't met in 2 years. And so they're really not providing the oversight, I think, that we really need in this case.
Gwen, what are your thoughts?
The oversight committee has never been able to get information from the ambulance service, and they have not had the cooperation of the hospitals. Who are the legal monitors. Most counties own ambulance service. They've never given it up. Ours, Athens Regional, had so much political influence that they got the legislature to give it to the hospital, and it was an important part of the hospital's revenue at its very beginning. I agree that we ought to go ahead and admit that we've had a fast deal of $100,000 a year, and that really have no control over it. And the minute we take control, the hospitals will back off because nobody really wants ambulance service.
Yeah, commissioners who have been appointed to the oversight committee, tell me that they've been reaching out, trying to find any information, like when's our next meeting? Can I get some information about what this committee does? And they've gotten really no meaningful reply is what they tell me, which is just crazy. And we're paying, it's not that much, but we're paying $100,000 a year to the hospitals for the service. And we should have some amount of say, like the public should have some say over how this all goes down. But right now we kind of don't.
The reason that we've been doing that since 1969, think about how long that is, is because we are greedy. We don't want to spend our money on ambulance service, and we don't want the liability of ambulance service. When I was CEO, of course, we looked at everything, and I would go to these county joint meetings of all the area, and the biggest thing that they would talk about their problems with ambulance service. I remember Al Cray said, nobody wants ambulance service.
Yeah, it's very expensive, which would be the downside of the county taking over for sure. Maybe the voters will take a look at this once we have all the information, which is really the important thing. Then we'll be able to make a decision. Do we want to let National keep doing it, or maybe use another company? Maybe we need to pay them more, to get better service, or maybe we'd really rather take it over ourselves. But right now, we just don't have the information to even to be able to make that decision, which I think is undemocratic.
Let's move on to a state story, where last week, the day before Thanksgiving, the jury returned guilty verdicts for Greg McMichael, William Bryant, and Travis McMichael. They were standing trial in Brunswick for the felony murder of Ahmaud Arbery, who was an unarmed Black man killed last year. Gwen, I know that you had something to share about that when you heard the news.
Well, I'm from the Brunswick area, and I was immensely proud of the leadership that the jury showed in this. The prosecution focused totally on facts and were aided greatly by a video proudly taken by one of the defendants. And you know, I think that that verdict, that America needed that verdict, and Georgia needed it as far as our image is concerned. And I'm very happy.
Well, you know, it just, you know, running down and chasing down and then shooting an unarmed man who was under attack, you know, when he, they say he went for the gun that was, you know, he was being chased down and murdered, basically. And so the jury, I think, did get it right. Anyway, it was just, he shouldn't be dead. And I wish that it had been handled differently in the beginning, but it ended up going to trial. And, you know, a lot of, there was concern, of course, mostly white jury, where the prosecution didn't really bring, you know, maybe didn't harp on that, but it was a mostly white jury. And that's always a cause for some, at least, concern when you're talking a black man killed by white people in Georgia. Well, that is all the time we have for this week. But, of course, the panel will be back next week. And stay with us. We'll have more Athens News Matters after the break.
Every day, NPR's All Things Considered includes news that keeps you ahead of the curve.
If this issue is not important enough for us to draw a line in the sand, what issue is?
Plus, the unexpected.
The wing, the skin, the neck, the heart, you're making chicken meatballs, cooking the knee cartilage.
All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley. 100 years ago, December 4th, 1921, three black men, Aaron Birdsong, Wes Hale, and George Lowe, were murdered, lynched by a mob not far from downtown Watkinsville. It wasn't the first lynching in this area. In addition to the Morris Ford lynching we talked about a few weeks ago, there was a mass lynching with nine victims in Watkinsville. That was in 1905, and in February of 1921, just 10 months before the murders of Birdsong, Hale, and Lowe, a man was taken from the Clark County Jail and horrifically murdered on the Clark-Oconee line. Modern-day activists are working hard to keep the names of the victims in our collective memory, to honor their lives, and to make sure that the horrible events of the past are not covered up in the present. One of those activists is John Cole Vodica, who this weekend is coordinating an event to mark the centennial of the murders of Aaron Birdsong, Wes Hale, and George Lowe. We spoke earlier this week. Tell me about this lynching that you are remembering at this service.
On December 4th, 1921, so 100 years ago this Saturday, Aaron Birdsong was an African-American farm worker. He went to the farmer who he was working for and asked for either a loan and or a chance to buy a piece of the farmer's property so he could farm it on his own. The farmer refused him. Here's where kind of the typical lynch narrative comes into play. According to press accounts and witnesses, white witnesses, Birdsong at some point that afternoon went to the farmer's house for whatever reason we don't know. My thinking would be to again ask for money and or a chance to own a piece of property. The white wife of the white farmer and her daughter were in the house, and they told the farmer when he returned home that Birdsong had been around the house. The farmer really rounded up a posse of white folks who went to Birdsong's home. Birdsong knew what was up, and Birdsong allegedly fired shots from his home out into the gathering of white folks in his yard. The white folks retreated and gathered up yet more people. And then the chase began. They eventually captured him that afternoon on December 4th and shot him to death. And then I think set him on fire, or at least prepared, a bonfire to burn him. And then someone in the mob got the idea that these two other gentlemen, Wes Hale and George Lowe, had assisted Birdsong along the way in providing him cover and maybe even ammunition. The mob went and rounded up these other two guys in their homes, brought them back to where Birdsong now lay dead, and set them on fire, and then shot them simultaneously or as they were burning to death. All three were shot and killed, or burned and killed, in the same location, and all related to the Birdsong incident.
Always so horrific.
We've got a horrible legacy here called lynching, and, you know, that morphed into convict leasing, which morphed into Jim Crow, which morphed into mass incarceration of poor African-American people. And, until we can acknowledge, that this is kind of where and how it started, and not to mention slavery, not to leave slavery out, but we've had this long legacy of violence toward people of color, or people who we perceive and, are going to take advantage of their freedom or whatever. And we who are in the majority have figured out violent and now less violent ways to deny people their basic human rights.
You would say that's still shaping our communities today, that history of racial violence.
It is. I think we're still living with the lingering legacies of lynching.
What sort of impact do you hope ceremonies recognizing the victims of lynching it has on those attending and just the rest of the community?
First and foremost, if we do nothing else for an hour, hour and a half on Saturday, we'll be educating folk. We'll be encouraging the wider community to acknowledge what happened. Even if you don't feel the outrage or the discomfort, just acknowledge the fact that this indeed happened. And then I think it's really important, and we've seen a lot of this over the last couple of years, of just remembering the names, giving those folks who died unnecessarily, violently, without due process, to give those folks at least the dignity and the recognition. We all bear some responsibility for remembering and then hopefully acting on what's happened.
Would you say people have lost a sense of just how horrific an actual lynching was when they compare current events to past lynchings?
Yeah, I think so. That so-and-so was messing with my white woman, so let's go get him. Mm-hmm. So-and-so was walking through an abandoned house under construction, so let's go get him. When you take the law into your own hands and become judge, jury, and executioner, that fits the definition of a lynching. But when you equate something that's happening today to something that happened 100 years ago or 60 years ago or whenever, there's always going to be some, it may not be the best comparison. Still, lives are lost, and individuals or a group of individuals made the decision to take that person's life.
John Cole Vodica is coordinating an event to mark the centennial of the murders of Aaron Birdsong, Wes Hale, and George Lowe. We spoke earlier this week. As the holidays approach, requests for assistance from charitable organizations are on the rise.
But all you have to give is 70 cents a day and the time it takes to make one free phone call.
And that means we are supported by philanthropic donations from folks like yourself.
They're asking for donations to help the dog and her puppies.
There's more than one way to give to an organization, though. Money may be generous, But in today's overscheduled world, there's another resource that may be even more valuable than your dollars, and that is your time. If you've got the spirit of the season or are simply looking for a tax write-off, how do you know what is the best way to help a cause you care about? Is it better to help a charity by donating your time as a volunteer or by opening your wallet? Recently, I took this question to Tony Mallon, clinical associate professor in the School of Social Work and director of the Institute for Nonprofit Organizations. He offered several tips for finding the best way to help organizations that help others. First, consider what your finances will allow.
If you're a younger person just starting out your career and maybe you have not accumulated a large savings or your salary isn't as high enough to donate a large amount of money, then you may feel as though volunteering is better. Or on the other end, if you're someone who's retired and on a fixed income and maybe is not working full-time anymore, again, volunteering may be the best choice for you.
Another thing to consider is what skills you bring to the table and whether they match with the mission of the organization.
Maybe you have legal experience, accounting experience, technology experience. A lot of nonprofits can really benefit from that. So I think the key thing is to really find the organization that whose mission matches with your interest, but then whose needs match with what you are most able to provide.
If you're not sure whether or not you want to donate your money to a charity and you have the time and the skills, volunteering can be a great way to learn more about what the organization does.
And so that can actually be a way to determine if it's an organization you would like to donate money to down the road.
But before you pick up the phone and arrange your first volunteering session, think carefully about what the organization does. The structure of the organization and its mission can give you clues about whether donations of money or time are more appropriate.
Some organizations solicit donations to provide scholarships for young people. They would be ones that probably wouldn't need a lot of volunteers, but they would definitely need people to donate money.
Finally, no matter how much you may support a particular nonprofit, you've got to ask yourself whether volunteering for it would be enjoyable and if you would have the time for it.
I know I have friends who volunteer for the Humane Society because they simply enjoy being with animals. And other people either don't have the time for that or don't necessarily enjoy that, but they still want to support animal well-being, so they'll make a donation.
And both are appreciated.
I don't think you need to think of this as mutually exclusive or one is necessarily better than the other. It's really what's the best fit for you and then what is most in need for an organization.
So whether you decide to support a charitable organization with your time or your money, there are plenty of organizations out there that need your support. And what better time than the season of giving to share your gifts with them?
Hi, my name is Rachel Hopkins, and I'm the marketing coordinator for Athens-Clark County Transit. Now that our fare-free categories include senior citizens, people with disabilities, youth, Athens-Clark County government employees, and UGA students and staff, it makes it even easier to explore the benefits of having a public transit system. One of the reasons people love Athens is it's a small-town community that offers major benefits, like public transit and great public radio. To learn how you can become an underwriter, email wuga@uga.edu.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup. As a popular household pet, the Eastern Box Turtle is vulnerable to the illegal wildlife trade. Some efforts have been made to stop the illegal trade of Eastern Box Turtles. However, what happens to the turtles when they are recovered? Can they be returned to the wild? Dr. Tracy Tuberville, a researcher at the University of Georgia's Savannah River Ecology Laboratory, seeks the answer to this question. Welcome to Athens News Matters.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I just have a sense that I think most people just think, hey, you know, what's the problem here? We found a turtle trying to cross the road and we saved him. Tell us a little bit about how that's really not the best thing to do.
Well, you know, they're very attractive, gentle animals. So I do think people are drawn to them, that, you know, they might see them and encounter them pretty frequently. You know, and maybe having a few in captivity is not necessarily a bad thing, especially if it gets people excited about conserving them in the wild and making sure that they're protected, develops an appreciation for them. The problem is, you know, you pull too many out from the wild, especially for the trade. I think we as scientists are really just starting to get an understanding of just how big the scope of the trade is. I mean, we're talking about thousands that are being siphoned out of the wild.
Well, tell us a little bit more about how this illegal trade can actually damage the turtle's population or even the ecosystem.
In some species, not necessarily box turtles, they can be actually relatively easy to collect in large numbers, say in a wetland, if you're talking about aquatic species. So it can be really easy for a collector or two to basically wipe out a whole population, but it takes decades to recover a population once it's been decimated.
So you've been awarded a grant from the Animal Welfare Institute to evaluate the repatriation of eastern box turtles that have been recovered from the illegal wildlife trade. What steps do you plan to take to reintroduce these turtles back into the wild?
There's actually a lot of people across the country that are really helping tackle this problem. The step that we're tackling is really trying to decide, can these turtles be repurposed and contribute to wild populations conservation by releasing them back to the wild? And so our role has been to take this group of box turtles that was confiscated by South Carolina Department of Natural Resources law enforcement and transferred to us. We've released them on the Savannah River site. We put radio transmitters on them so that we could follow their movements and survival. So we're on our second year of monitoring. And another key piece of our project is to actually track wild resident turtles that already were there at the same site so we can see whether or not the turtles we released start behaving similarly.
How are they doing?
They did move more the first year than the wild resident, but they've really settled into their home range and are acting and behaving just like the wild turtles. We actually found some wild resident turtles to add to our study because we saw them interacting with the turtles we had released. So that was a pretty cool observation. We did have mortality in that first year, and I think it's important to calibrate your expectations of just how successful these efforts are going to be. Sometimes they're kept in poor conditions during the trade process, and so there's going to be higher mortality than you would see in wild populations. And the hope is that after they get a chance to recover, that it returns to what the normal expected survival would be. And that's actually what we're seeing. So that's pretty promising. And I think we have to just look at this as, you know, even if some animals don't survive the confiscation process, all those animals that do are a net gain to the population where we release them into.
Dr. Tracy Tuberville is a researcher at UGA's Savannah River Ecology Lab. Thanks for stopping by today.
Thank you.
From bluegrass to big band and beyond, the University of Georgia's Performing Arts Center rings in the holidays with a wide-ranging slate of offerings this month. WUGA's Michael Carden spoke to the Performing Arts Center director, Jeffrey Martin, about what's on tap. Here's their conversation.
Jeff, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us more about this great festival you have assembled? Who do you have coming?
We've got several guest artists coming in this month, including the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra with Wynton Marsalis, and the King Singers, who are coming over from England. And then we'll wrap it up with Ricky Skaggs and Kentucky Thunder, which is bluegrass.
Okay, let's talk first about the King Singers.
King Singers are a wonderful group from England, and they're six men. They sing a cappella, so unaccompanied vocal music. They have a long history. The group has been around for just over 50 years and actually performed here at the Performing Arts Center during our inaugural season. And they'll be doing a variety of pieces, older carols, traditional carols, some new and modern, more recent pieces. One song in particular they'll be doing is called Yule, Yule, Strålande Jul, which is a Swedish carol. So this is one of their most popular Christmas songs, their traditional carols, that talks about the shining light of Christmas and how it illuminates the land at this particular time of year. It's a beautiful piece.
And moving ahead and changing styles quite significantly. Talk about Ricky Skaggs a little bit.
Well, who doesn't love a little bluegrass? And, of course, he's like the master of bluegrass, of course. And we had him at the Performing Arts Center a couple of years ago, sold out that performance. He was so popular, I just knew we wanted to try to find an occasion to bring him back. So I was thrilled when his agent told me that he has a Christmas program available. So we're looking forward to an evening of traditional Christmas music, bluegrass style. It'll be a lot of fun.
Indeed. And the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra with the legendary Wynton Marsalis, how did that one come about?
Well, it's kind of one gift of COVID, I guess. You know, they were supposed to come to UGA right just a few weeks after the whole world shut down in spring of 2020. And it's one of the few performances I have been able to hold on to all of this time. We have rescheduled it multiple times, and finally we're able to settle on the Christmas tour, and which I had always wanted to bring the Christmas show. It's very hard to book that show, as you could probably imagine. It's so popular. And so I was absolutely thrilled when it all just kind of worked out that we're able to present Big Band Holidays. So they'll be touring. They're touring now, and we'll be touring for the first couple weeks of December before taking it to their home venue in New York City, where it always plays to packed crowds just before the holidays. So we're really looking forward to that.
Can you also talk about some of the student and community ensembles that we're going to hear from?
Yes, one of the biggest events every year at the Performing Arts Center is the Hugh Hodson School of Music's annual holiday concerts, and those really are kicking everything off. And they are such a wonderful opportunity to experience a variety of music from the School of Music, from the symphony orchestra to the brass band, the flute choir. You really get to see quite a variety of groups and styles and genres of music. We also serve as a venue for some community groups. We're pleased to host the Athens Choral Society for their annual holiday concert. They too had to take last year off, so they're really excited to be back this year. And then we have the Georgia Children's Chorus, their annual concert here. So there's really a variety of things. Whatever your interest in music, I feel like we've got it for you this month, and we're excited to welcome people back.
And what kind of provisions can people expect to encounter relative to COVID?
Well, we are strongly encouraging everyone to wear masks in the building at all times at the Performing Arts Center. We've got signage all over, and we'll be reminding everyone and encouraging everyone to do that. It's something that we all can do to help these performances continue to happen. And many of the artists are coming here, and they are asking that our audiences respect that request as well.
How do you get tickets?
Well, tickets are available for most of the performances, although they are going quickly, I will add. Our website is pac.uga.edu, or you can visit or call the Performing Arts Center box office. We're happy to help.
Jeffrey Martin, director of the University of Georgia Performing Arts Center, thank you for all that you do for the community. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. For more information about the Holiday Music Festival, you can visit pac.uga.edu. I'm Michael Carden, WUGA.
And we should note that the UGA Performing Arts Center is a financial supporter of WUGA. You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia. Our producers are Martin Matheny, Gene Davis, Devins Wald, Robin Whetstone, Kara Nelson, and Abby Buston. And we'd like to extend a special welcome back to our friend Sophie Gratis, who spent some time with us last year as an intern and who now joins us again as one of our producers. Welcome back, Sophie. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram, where we give you updates throughout the week on the stories we're working on for both Athens News Matters and our daily newscasts. For Alexia Ridley, I'm Chris Shoup. Thanks for listening to Athens News Matters. Stay safe out there, and we'll be back with you next week. Enjoy your weekend.